Welcome to another episode of Pardon My Enthusiasm, a horror podcast. Film, spooks, controversy, death, and crime, where the eerie is discussed. I'm your host, Damaris Montufar. I am a people again, kind of. This upcoming week, I'm going to get really back into it because I've been a little all over the place with my recording schedule and pushing out my episodes. I've been a little overwhelmed with schoolwork, just some like personal stuff. You know how she goes, but we're back at it. I actually just finished recording a school assignment. It was a uni assignment about you're speaking to a cult leader's followers as someone trying to like scale them back, whatever, kind of like deprogramming. I chose to do Charles Manson because I'm stupidly familiar with him, but really all of the options I was like dang, but I went about it as if I was speaking to Linda Kasabian, and I'm like, hey girl, like I get it, but like you really don't have to do that. So here's for hoping I get a good grade on it, but let's get back to it. Today's episode, Christy. Nefarious, yet unassuming. Last time we talked about Timothy Evans and Jan Svartvik and the entire mess that was his trial and execution. Now we take a look at the killer, John Christy, suspected of 8 or more murders during the 1940s and 1950s before he was executed. What is his history? Who were his victims? And what makes this killer important? We're going to try to tackle that. Let's go. So the first player we will be discussing is Ethel Simpson, born 1888 in Halifax. Christy and Ethel married May 10, 1920. Their relationship was not very sexual because Christy was fond of prostitutes and impotent with his wife. The pair never had children. Ethel unfortunately had a miscarriage early in their union. Ethel had various jobs during the 4 years the pair were separate, living with her siblings between Halifax, Bradford, and Sheffield. John Christy was born April 8, 1899, so Ethel was just a pinch older than him, although I couldn't quite find what day or month she was born. And he was born in Northam, West Riding of Yorkshire, England. Woo! He is the 6th out of 7 children. His childhood was erratic. Not many friends. People described him as someone who kept to themselves. His father was an uncaring man, unaffectionate and authoritarian with a temper. He punished his children for any offense. His mother and sister offered a mixed relationship of belittling but coddling him all the same. His first recorded experience with death was when his grandfather passed in his family home. Christy explained having feared him through his life and now seeing him so mute gave him a sense of power. Throughout his life, Christy experienced issues with impotence and with a history of sexual failures. He was dubbed Reggie No Dick and Can't Do It Christy, because I actually don't think I mentioned that his full name is John Reginald Christy. His parts worked. It was all psychological. His issues when it came to his impotence, a connection with his sex partner made the experience not so good, which is later kind of like, and we'll see, we'll touch on that again. But this is why he stuck to prostitutes. It's interesting where he struggled, because Christy was smart. He excelled in mathematics, even winning a scholarship when he was 11 for the Halifax Secondary School. He was a Boy Scout, sang in the choir, and after he finished school, Christy worked as an assistant cinema projectionist, which sounds like the coolest job ever, because I really like film. But John Christie's big job that was part of his defense for why he was trustworthy was his time in the military. From 1916 to 1918, he was in the army, having enlisted in September of 1916 and being set to work as an infantryman in April 12, 1917. From December 13th 1923 to August 15th, 1924, he was in the Royal Air Force. So you kind of sum it all up. He was only actually an infantryman for about a year, and then he was an airman for about a year. And during his time with the army, though, he served in France, where he was in an attack that injured him with mustard gas, being why his service was quite short. This event, Christie claims, left him blind and mute, unable to speak for 3.5 years. But this is unsubstantiated by all records, like literally everything. His story is explained as being a lie for attention and as a means to excuse certain personality traits, such as his awkwardness and quiet speaking voice. Among with lying about his medical history, Christie had a very heavy criminal past. January 10, 1921, Christie and Ethel lived in Halifax. He worked as a postman, and he was convicted for stealing postal orders. This was his first conviction, serving 3 months in prison on April 12, 1921. And on January 15, 1923, he done did it again, for having money on false pretenses and violent conduct. He received 12 months probation. Next was larceny, so theft, in 1924, gaining him another 3 and then another 6 months in prison. On May 13, 1929, he was sentenced to 6 months prison labor for assaulting Maud Cole, a person he was living with. A physical attack to the head with a cricket bat. And to wrap it up in an odd parallel with his later victim, Tim Evans, he stole a car and went to prison for it for 3 months, November 1st, 1933. In 1934, Ethel and Christie seemed to have smoothed things over, and after his release from prison, they got back together. Overall, Christie cleaned up from here and out, I guess, but his bad habits of picking up prostitutes remained. Initially, the couple moved to 10 Rillington in 1937 on the top floor, but in 38, they moved down to the ground floor where Christie's murders would all go down. Sometime in 1939, right after the start of World War II, Christie became a war reserve police. No background check, just accepted. He worked in Harrow Road Police Station, where he met Gladys Jones. They began having an affair, which did not end until 1943, when her husband returned from war to discover them together. And this is where I want to bring up that emotional connection thing when it came to his impotence, because obviously he knew her, he worked with her. They had a full-fledged affair. Like, it wasn't just a couple of sex here and there, like with prostitutes. But I guess apparently he did have his regular prostitutes that he liked. It actually comes up in one of the films, so we can talk about that in a little bit more. But that means that I'm making numbers in my head or whatever, but so we started in 39. Let's just assume, to be nice, that they didn't actually start their affair until 40. That's 3 years. They're a 3-year-long relationship with a woman, but he can't get a Woody for his wife. And honestly, let's not even get me started on that. But in 1943, Christie left the special constables, or the war reserve police, and became a clerk at a radio factory. And let's discuss the layout of 10 Rillington for a second, because it is super important. I kind of wanted to touch on it a little more in the Timothy Evans one, but it's not as relevant necessarily, but it'll build upon it. So definitely, if you haven't heard the other one, go hear it. And if you have heard it, let's just sniff into ourselves the information that we already put out there. But this building had 3 floors. It was a brick home, garden in the back, built during the 1870s. So it had a very familiar style for a lot of the homes in that area and a lot of homes of that time. The halls were open, so everyone's halls, with only the top floor having privacy. You open the door and it's a long corridor that has a split off. It's like a fork. And to the left is the stairs. To the right is three doors. One directly to the right, you take a couple steps, another one to the right, and then one straight ahead. Those three doors are the first floor flat. They're connected. That's all the people. I'm actually not 110 if each room connects into itself from there, but those three rooms encompass the first flat. And then you go straight up the stairs and you have more rooms. But the ground floor and third floor had one bedroom, a room for the kitchen, and a living room room. The second floor had a combo of a kitchen living room room and a separate bedroom. There was a communal bathroom outside and just before the garden with the connecting wall to the washroom where Geraldine and Beryl were later found. And this was all paper-thin walls, so everyone knew everything. And just to kind of keep going with the visual, we already laid out the first floor. So we're at the front door. We already know what is to the fork to the right, to the fork to the left, you go up the stairs. As soon as you hit the stairs right over there, to your left is the door to the living room kitchen. Straight ahead is the bedroom. You then curve to go up the stairs, and that's where you get kind of the other, why did I stutter? Oh my gosh. That's where you get the third floor. Ideally, I would have wanted the third floor because they got the most privacy, but I guess also the bathroom, that's a lot of effort. And then the backyard, this whole thing stinks. It sucks. I do not want to live here. And now we walk into the event. From 1943 to 1953, Christie is estimated to have murdered over 8 people, strangling them to death after gassing them and raping some of them. First, we have Ruth Furrest, who was 21 when Christie killed her. His first kill, by his accounts. Coming from Austria, she was a prostitute, so Christie brought her home when Ethel was away, where he strangled her with a rope in their bed, hiding her under the floorboards of their living room until he buried her in the backyard shortly after. Then was Muriel Amelia Eady on October 7, 1944, who he met while working at the radio factory. He promised her a concoction that would work better than anything her quack doctors had given her for her bronchitis. As his mixture made its way into her system, she became unconscious. Edie was raped and strangled and buried along with First. So Christie's special sauce was domestic gas, coal gas, and Freyr balsam, which is balsamic resin and ethanol. He would have his victim sit back in a jar. He would fill it with the balsam and two tubes. One tube connecting to a face contraption for them to wear. Think a mix-shaped homemade for when you're like at the hospital and they're like asking you to breathe kind of a thing. There was two tubes, or we already covered that, but the one was for the breathing. And once they were breathing, he would use the other tube to mix in the domestic gas. He had it connected just to a gas line, and it's frustrating. But then we know came the Evans. To lightly recap, Beryl was the wife to the upstairs tenant. Her and their baby daughter Geraldine were strangled by Christie and hidden in the washroom. Tim Evans, the husband, was blamed for their deaths and executed. Throughout the investigation, the police did not press the Christies. They did a piss poor job of searching the home, where they would have found Furris and Edie. The police ignored all information that placed doubt on Mr. Evans as the murderer, and they even used Ethel and Christie as witnesses to testify against Evans. For 3 years, he kept calm and clear, although calm is subjective here, because Christie was a raging racist. With all of the history in the building, they needed to fill the vacant flats, and the new neighbors were from the West Indies, and they were black. Christie would argue with them, and apparently Ethel accused one of the neighbors of assault. they fought to keep access of the garden exclusively to themselves, for racist reasons, I am sure, but also because it held a lot of Christie's secrets. December 14, 1952, Christie was done with how much Ethel interfered with his extra activities, so he strangled her while she was in bed. She's with family, she's traveling, she's busy, she's ill, she just stepped out. Excuses upon excuses for why Ethel had not been seen since the 12th of December. Christie even went as far as claiming Ethel had rheumatism. Oh my god, I was like stuck with rheumatoiditis, but whatever. Rheumatism. So she couldn't write to you. I'll just do it for her. All of his stories contradicted, and they were catching up to him. Like, he wasn't even selective for who he told what. It's like the upstairs neighbor. Oh, yeah, this. The neighbor across the street. Oh, it's this other one. But, bro, they know each other. So, well. He also started selling their possessions to keep him afloat since he had quit his job. Then he went about collecting unemployment. Finally, January 26, 1953, he forged some paperwork and cleared Ethel's bank account. He was free, so his killing picked up again, and from January 19 to March 6, 1953, Kathleen Maloney, Rita Nelson, and Hector McLennan were all brought back to his home where he murdered them, his final three victims. Kathleen Maloney was a prostitute. Rita Nelson was visiting her sister from Belfast while 6 months pregnant. And Hectorina McLennan first met Christie in a cafe while living with her boyfriend, Alex Baker. The pair stayed at 10 Rillington for a while, and through his friendship, he swayed Miss Hectorina to accompany him alone to his home, where he proceeded to murder her, and then, when confronted by Baker about her whereabouts, he simply pled to have not seen her. He kept the ruse by checking in and assisting in searches for her. Part of what is known is that he used the gassing trick on them, adjusting his methods by using a connection in the kitchen instead of random rooms or just flooding them in differently. After they were all carbon monoxide out, he did his usual and strangled them with a rope. With the three victims, these last three, it is explicitly known that he raped them throughout the process, likely even after they died. These three women and Edie were raped multiple times, and these events lightly crept into necrophilia, since it's not thought that he stopped just because they had died. March 20, 1953, Christie moved out of 10 Rillington, subletting it illegally and getting into a heap of issues with the landlord for it. His move brought him to Rowton House and King's Cross, booking a stay for about a week that ended early, after only four nights. After Christie moved and his subletters were kicked out, another tenant was allowed to use and renovate the kitchen, which is where his last bit of business was hidden. There was a small closet, let's call it a pantry, in the kitchen that Christie had hidden his last victims in, covering it with wallpaper. But during this update by the tenant, Bresford Brown, he removed the wallpaper while installing some brackets, discovering the door, and behind it, bodies. Immediately, he asked another tenant to look inside to verify his findings, and they contacted the police. Eyes were wide for Christie. March 24 is when word got out, and Christie made a quick exit from his room. 7 days later, on the 31st of March, Christie was apprehended at Putney Bridge. He was questioned, and on his person was some money and clippings about his old neighbor, Timothy Evans. Christie's confession came slowly, first admitting to the women behind the wallpaper, followed by the murder of his wife, Ethel. Once they indicated that they had found the other bodies in the garden, He folded. Then came the painful admission that it was him who murdered Beryl and Geraldine Evans, not Timothy Evans. His admission of Geraldine is not as firm as that of Beryl, but regardless, what trash, you know? His trial was solely about the murder of Ethel, occurring in the same court as Timothy's. Everybody loves a good old insanity plea, but it was not bought. He was evaluated, and while it was decided that he was a little out there, specifically hysterical personality, he was not insane. No go for playing insanity. After 85 minutes, Christie was found guilty and sentenced to death. July 15, 1953, at Penningtonville Prison, Christie was hung by the same executioner who hung Evans, Albert Perrier Point. Christie, being believed of all these crimes, caused an outcry over Timothy Evans's execution. Initially, Evans was still considered guilty because they felt Christie confessed to those killings in order to sustain his insanity plea. Like, look, I'm just killing all these people, I killed the baby, whatever. This, of course, was unacceptable. People were mad. A controversial case and a final decision that fueled the fight for abolishing the death penalty. It's okay, so kind of a tidbit. Apparently, Christie complained about his nose itching when he was brought to be executed. You know, they put like a bag over you so they don't gotta look at you. And so the executioner apparently said, it won't bother you for long, which I'm gonna live on that. I'm gonna live on that for the rest of my life. But now Christie is suspected of 8+ murders because Christie apparently had a pube collection. Pubic hair that did not match all of his victims, but it's super unsubstantiated. Some of the stuff that I read discussed a theory that 4 clumps of hair were likely those of people he raped post-mortem. Or that there was a whole another batch of trauma he incurred because it was such an isolated collection. It's kind of weird. There's also the fact that he was a special constable and that perhaps he used this as a means to acquire more victims. So maybe he didn't kill more people, but during his time as a constable, he did rape more women, clip some pubes, kept them. But it's just like, it's really gross. It's really weird to think about that he had a pube collection. I believe one of them matched one of the other women, but that just kind of really plays into the question of necrophilia, which we're going to get into a little more after, but ew, it's just, it's a really, it's not like a horribly horrible case or man, I guess. Like, I can think of many other people where talking about them, you're just like, gross, gross, they're just nasty, but I don't know, especially trying to think about the fact that he likely kept raping the women even after they had died, the pubic hair collection, the fact that he was in a place of authority often. I definitely don't think it was just these women. And media, my fave. This one was kind of fun. Just the media was not, I don't know, it's interesting. I guess we'll get into that. But so we've got a few things of note because it's funny. There's a play, Christie in Love, from 1969, and it's a psychological analysis of sorts touching on the sadistic nature of society. Sounds kind of rad, honestly. I definitely would watch it, but there are other oddities, such as a series of paintings by Brett Whitley, and a song named Christie by Lord Cobra. And then obviously last week we talked about the Ballad of Timothy Evans, and I just love when there's really weird things. But anyway, there, as far as like films and stuff, we're gonna start with the eldest one, which is 10 Rillington Place, 1971. And this one places the Evans as having already had baby Geraldine before they moved into the house, and the movie overall is kind of slow paced, and it definitely falls more under the drama and speculation. It's very definitely 70s made for TV, just exactly what it is. It's not great. It's not bad. I feel like out of, it's actually, I think, the last one I saw out of all the media. And I'm usually a big fan of old stuff. I'm like, oh my God, did this movie come out in like 1915? Because I'm like so here for it, man. It's just like so cool. But in this specific instance, I was just like, okay. It was just way too fakey feeling. It's, everything was just a little drawn in a way that felt inauthentic. But next, we have Rillington Place, 2016. And this one is a BBC One miniseries or limited event kind of a thing. It's three parts, and it really covers Tim, actually very thoroughly and very well for all the random things that I read about him. His personality truly shines, and you really believe that he's just kind of a confused sap, which sounds kind of icky, but that's exactly how he's discussed. Just this, like, bro that's a little like, what? Oh, man, I just, oh, dang, you figured it out. And it's like, okay. Although one of the things that I found very interesting was that the television show has Ethel and John being apart for about 9 years, almost 10 years. And she thought he was dead. That's actually kind of how it opens with Ethel. She's got like a letter and she's like, oh my God. And she's with her brother and she goes to meet up with John. And she's like, Reg, I thought you were dead. I thought you were dead these 9 years and like whatever. And I'm just like, dang, brother, this is bonkses. It's very good overall. And it's got Jodie Comer. I love Jodie Comer. Although she's not in it for very long, obviously, because she plays Beryl. They really go into the youthfulness of their relationship, which I think is very important. When they move in, it's the Christies are in their house doing their thing and they hear the door open. And so he goes to look at a peephole and the couple comes in and Tim's got Beryl's eyes covered and he's like, I got a surprise for you. Yeah. And opens them and she's like, oh, okay. Well, you know, at least we're living together. And like, they're just very playful and she's very, I don't want to say flirtatious because I feel like that's going to set up a incorrect precedent, but she's very just like, oh, hi, Mr. Christie, thank you. And, oh, you know, oh, we've never lived on our own and thank you very much and, you know, that kind of a thing. Oh, of course, Mr. Christie, oh, thank you for keeping an eye on us and blah, blah, blah. And please don't make fun of my accent because my partner always does. I don't know what he calls it. Cogney? Whatever. Anyway, it's very nice though, and it's very convincing. Everyone's very sincere in their emotions, especially Tim. Like, he just seems so like, oh, all the time. And I'm like, yes, man, yes. And the final one also came out in 2016. This one is on Netflix. That's how I watched it. It's a whole TV show. It's called Murder Map. And I believe it's still running, although German Netflix only has up to 2016, 2017 or something. It's only got three seasons and it goes all throughout Europe and like picks locations and talks about all the murders in those locations. Cause you have to think it's such a condensed area, London. And she's been kicking for a long time. There is a lot of history there. And the specific episodes, cause there's two parts that cover John Christie and Timothy Evans, is Notting Hill Horror. And that one specifically is in 2016. Oh, excuse me. They talked about his not speaking for a few years, which has been heavily countered in any analysis of his case, though. And they separated for the decade or so before suddenly getting back together. It definitely has less explanation, but it's what, each episode's like 40 minutes, so you don't get quite as much. But then also, like, the BBC miniseries, it's only like an extra 60 minutes or something, but it's not bad. It's fun. It's a fun show overall. I would definitely recommend it if you just kind of want to watch a little something. I have a couple of final thoughts and stuff that I want to wrap up about this, and it's primarily, like I said, we're going to talk into the necrophilia side of all of this. And so necrophilia is like a weird one. Anything to do with like dead stuff has very interesting places in my soul. But there's a discussion on how necrophiliac-y Christie was, since he did, like, it's not necessarily understood that he went into wanting to violate dead people. There isn't very heavy talk on how far it went. Like, this is gonna get gross sounding, but it's the whole possible accident. Like, he was a necrophile on accident because he was just, I think like people who like erotic asphyxiation and it's like something went wrong, you accidentally die, maybe your partner doesn't pick up on it, so on and so forth. Don't really know how that works, but that's kind of the idea that, oh, he's only technically a necrophile because they died, but he didn't just go abusing dead people. But I'm like, I don't know, it's still gross to have sex with dead people. And even worse, it's rape because the dead can't consent. And obviously, these women never consented at no place were they just like, oh my God, yeah, Chrissy, like, let's go. No, it's just, it's weird. I don't know how I feel about it. I don't know what to think about it. Just necrophilia in general is so wild because there's so many rights to dead bodies. Oh, let's not even get me started on like people rights, but dead, like corpses, you can't just take organs. You have to be an organ donor. There's all of this. There's a lot that comes to dead people when it comes to consent. Like, there's just so many rules. And I feel like I'm getting way too like analytical with it, but he's still a necrophile, I would say. Even if it was an accident that he just kept raping people after they died, like, you're still not only a fucking rapist and a murderer, but you are a necrophiliac. And it's just like gross. But does it matter? Does it change it for you? Or is it one of those like he's already so terrible, it doesn't matter how much more terrible he gets? I don't know. Oh, also, does being a necrophile make you an even worse like killer in general? Because I think of people like other famous serial killers and stuff like that, and how like Ed Kemper or Jeffrey Dahmer or even Ted Bundy, who apparently like assaulted the corpses after, like, are they grosser? Are they very notorious because that's part of it? Like, that's just like a different extent that we almost can't fathom with. Is it worse? I think it's a little worse. I don't know if that makes me a bad person. Like, overall, through and through, I'm like, please don't violate people. Please don't do bad things to people. But especially when I hear about like necrophilia, I'm like, I just think of maggots. I know that that's not quite how that works. It's not like they grow in 2 seconds, but maggots gross me out. Like, I'm cool with them, I guess, but they really gross me out. So I'm just like, and it reminds me of that movie Contracted, whatever. Oh, we should talk about that more later. But how do you feel about it? Does it make you uncomfy? Because it kind of makes me uncomfy. And how do you feel about the death penalty? I have a hard time. It's a loaded conversation for me. I almost feel like I shouldn't get into it. Unless you want to chat me up, we can chat it up too. But it sucks because, like, Timothy Evans did not deserve to die. Like, I can't imagine he actually killed Geraldine. And overall, it's just, dude, he was set up. And what is with investigations? Oh, but anyway, if you can find it in your heart to please go to Apple Podcasts and leave me a review. I think you can also do it in like Stitcher, but just, wherever. But I know that Apple Podcasts is the big one, and that would be so, like, so nice of you. Thank you. As always, thank you very much for listening. And if you are ever so inclined, please follow me on Instagram at pardonmyenthusiasm.podcast, Facebook at pardonmyenthusiasm.podcast, and Twitter at pardonmepod. Bye.